Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I am your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host, Tony Ricci. If you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button, like the show. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Our special guest today is Dr. Mike T. Nelson. He has a PhD, CSCS, and CISSN. He's a research fanatic. I do like that. Specializes in metabolic flexibility, heart rate variability, which we will talk about, as well as human performance. He spent two decades, probably more, actually. It seems like, you know, it's weird. Like, I feel like we've been doing this, you know, for like half a century. It's like,
because we're like old
forever. But so he's been doing it a long time. He's got a PhD in exercise physiology. And he has, I didn't realize this, he had a master's degree in mechanical engineering. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You're currently an associate prof at the Carrick Institute. You're a university instructor at Rocky Mountain University. I actually have a couple of students currently going to Rocky Mountain.
Nice.
Yeah, you're the creator of the Flex Diet Certification and Physiologic Flexibility Cert and Human Optimization Specialist with the Special Forces Experience. You're also the Research and Human Performance Science Advisor at Tecton. They make the ketone ester drink. You've published research in both physiology and engineering peer-reviewed journals, which is kind of a cool combo.
Not bad.
Yeah, and Mike's even been called in to share his techniques with top military agencies. In his free time, he enjoys spending time with his wife, lifting odd objects, going to metal concerts, and the coolest of all, because I am an ocean lover like you, he kiteboards, which
That's
is,
right.
You know what's interesting about kiteboarding? Tony, have you been feeling the hurricane-like winds for the last few days?
I'm in the wrong spot.
Picking up a little bit. Come on out, Mike.
Mike, this might be the wind. I'm like, wow, this is like the windiest winter, which is great for kiteboarding. It's very bad for paddleboarding. We get blown around all over the place.
That's why you have to do both. On your windy days, you kiteboard, and not windy days, you go paddleboard.
That would make sense. I've watched them kiteboard, and here's the thing. Kiteboarding to me is like, you know, it's like learning how to surf or learning how to golf. There's a certain amount of time you have to put into it so that you don't kill yourself out there. And I'm thinking, I tried, like, for instance, I took golf lessons a long time ago. I'm like, you know what? That looks like a good way to kill a day. And then I realized, wow, you really have to put a lot of time into this to be somewhat competent. Same with kiteboarding. It's like, wow, do I have that kind of time? I don't know if I do. I would just flail. It's one of those things where, God, I wish I'd picked it up like 10 or 20 years ago or whatever. But yeah, the skill, there's a certain skill level that I don't know if you could even explain it to someone who has no idea what it feels like to fly on the water. I mean, maybe you could. I don't know, Mike. Could you?
Yeah, it's like you said, it's complex because for listeners, you have a bar with four lines that go up to this, like, looks like an upside down flying parachute thing, and use that to pull you across the water on a hybrid between a wakeboard, surfboardy kind of thing. And then the nice part is, if you do it correctly, you can then send the kite straight up above you, and then you can fly through the air for, you know, so far and land pretty nice. But like, the best I've done so far is 26 feet up for like 150 feet for like 6 seconds.
Wow. And
there's pros that do, you know, way more than that. But it's so fun. Like, even if you've done any extreme sports or anything, like being in the air and just flying around for like 3 seconds feels like an eternity. It feels like forever.
That's
a lot of fun,
feet,
a lot of reps.
Man, that's a good deal above the ocean surface.
Yes.
26 feet.
Yeah. The first few times you even do it, even just doing 6 feet the first time, you look down and you're like,
whoa.
Oh shit.
I know. I can only imagine what that feels like, because the few times I've paddled in somewhat rough water and the water carries you up, even if you're just a few feet above the water, it's like, holy shit, I'm going to crash and my head's going to hit something. So,
if you come out today, Mike, you could probably, with the wind, I'm looking out the window, you could probably get to the Azores in about 3 hours.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh, too much. Hey, Mike, you're a big proponent, or you talk quite a bit about heart rate variability. And I think, Tony, I don't know if you've used that, if that's a tool you guys use with fighters, you and Corey.
We do, yeah.
The thing I have, before you explain what it is and the importance, I think my Garmin watch attempts to measure it, but I think it's just bullshit. Mm-hmm. My watch, I'm like, this data is not right. Mm-hmm. And I would have to wear some sort of EKG monitor to get true heart rate variability. So could you comment on that a little bit? You know, what it is, the importance of it, trying to actually measure it while I got my watch on and I'm paddling out wherever.
Yeah. So simply heart rate variability, if we measure the average heart rate during an activity, it gives us some, you know, useful information. If we then take the variability analysis of it, that gives us like the next level in-depth info. So when we do that, it tells us the status of our autonomic nervous system. So for the listeners, you've got the parasympathetic side, which is like pushing on the brake of the car, heart rate slows down, more rest and relaxation. And then you have the sympathetic side, which is the gas pedal. Push on the gas harder, more stress, but you get higher performance, the car goes faster, your heart rate goes faster. So HRV is actually really accurate, if it's done correctly, to tell you the status of your autonomic nervous system. And we know a whole bunch of things can both acutely and chronically change that. The biggest thing for training is a high level of training stress or stressors the day before can show up in your heart rate variability. So the nice part about that is it gives you a physiologic measure of yourself or the athlete's stress level. Sometimes they're good at telling you where it is, sometimes they're not. The caveat, as you mentioned, though, is a couple things. One, when do you do the measurement? Because the context is super important. Mm-hmm. So the downside with a lot of wearables now is they're trying to put HRV in everything and they're measuring it all the time. And so if you have a nice cup of coffee or you go out paddleboard or you get stressed or all these things will change your heart rate variability. And that's not a flaw in the measurement. That's just how it's actually being done. So for most people, you're going to do heart rate variability over the course of a night because that's relatively stable. When I work with athletes, we do it first thing in the morning, usually in a seated position. So that way you're doing it at a one-time measurement after the most stable period, which is normally going to be sleep. With that, we usually use a heart rate strap, although there are some finger sensors that can work. If you look at, like, I have an Oura ring, I also have a Garmin. Oura is actually pretty accurate with what they report for heart rate variability. They've published that data. The downside is it's accumulating over the course of the night. So if you have things that change your sleep or your sleep quality or duration, that can affect your score a little bit. And then also, if you have athletes that have a very low resting heart rate, you can run into something called parasympathetic saturation, which is the fancy term meaning their parasympathetic tone is so high or their vagal tone is so high, you don't see a lot of their other stressors. So if we use like the beach analogy, imagine like you're on the beach and you have these monster waves that are just kind of obliterating everything else. So with those athletes, we typically have to have them do a command and measurement first thing in the morning, and we put them in a standing position. So you put your body under a little bit of stress. Now we can kind of see some of those background stressors. So I have a Garmin too, and they've published some stuff. The overnight on Garmin is actually pretty accurate. Again, all of them use kind of their own algorithm, so the numbers aren't really a direct one-to-one comparison. But again, the issue is, when are they giving you that data? So unfortunately, a lot of wearables now, like I mentioned, they're trying to give you more data all the time. And again, without that context, it's not useful, right? So I go to a hard, heavy session and it says, hey, your heart rate variability sucks. I'm like, well, yeah, I want to be sympathetic. If I want that output, that's what I want at that particular point. If I'm chilling out in the evening, then I want the inverse of that. So again, the context of when the measurement is actually being done is super important.
Mike, what would be, so when you're looking at the numbers, what would be the numbers for, quote, a good variability, a poor one, a great one? What is that? What are the units on that? What's the value?
What would the value be? So if, this is a big if they give you the actual raw data, you'll see it's measured in milliseconds. Mm-hmm. And so what that is it's actually how much variability you have from one beat to the next. And this is fine scale variability, you know, 20 to 110 milliseconds. So very, very, very tiny. In general, the more you have, the more parasympathetic side of the equation you're on. And that's a good thing. Like we have long-term data showing that it's related to cardiac mortality and some pathologies and other things like that. If you just get the raw data and it's accurate, you know, like 20 to 40 milliseconds, I would say is probably average. There's some data showing that, you know, 20 to 25 may even be average from a general population. Athletes tend to do better in heart rate variability. The other issue is that some devices, like I use the Athlete app a lot, that takes that score and it translates it to a 1 to 100 scale. Because like telling you something in milliseconds isn't that super helpful for people. So they'll have 100 is like close to 100% parasympathetic. A 1 is like 100% sympathetic. You're possibly dead or something bad happened to you. And with that, they'll give you a little indicator light. They'll say like green, amber, or red. And that's to try to tell you the change that you had in terms of, should I continue with my training? Should I be, you know, pull back a little bit? Or should I take kind of more of a rest day?
Could you explain? I'm sorry, Tony, do you have a question?
No, well, just quickly, Mike. So, and maybe Joe, you're getting in, you'll get into this. You talking about optimal timing, Mike. So, you know, is that just during sleep? Is it is post-workout recovery of any value, or what does that really entail when you say optimal, if we could?
Yeah, so most of the research is done with either a sleep measurement, which there really isn't that much data until recently. Most of the measurement was done with a one-time command and measurement in the morning. So like when I did my study in energy drinks, we looked at heart rate variability. But at the time, we didn't have wearable tech that was good enough to give us that data. So they physically had to come into the lab. They came in the morning. They had either an energy drink or they had a placebo. And we would have them rest for a period of time. And then we would do their heart rate variability. So a lot of the data going back up until the last couple of years, that was kind of the standard measurement. Now with wearables, you can technically measure HRV at any one point, and it will tell you the status of the autonomic nervous system. The downside is you have to be aware of other things that will change it. So if you did a hard workout, that'll change it. If you drank caffeine, that'll change it. Even drinking a lot of water over a short period of time will alter your heart rate variability. So what I use like post-training, if we did like a hard session on the rower or the bike, and I want to see like, how is that athlete faring with that training stressor? Like, what is their physiologic perception of that? I'll take a 1 to 2 minute heart rate recovery because I think that has a little bit more data post exercise. So that's just how fast you got from a peak, how fast are you coming back down over 1 to 2 minutes? And that's actually a very good measure of what's called parasympathetic reactivation. So if you're more trained, you're in a better state, basically your heart rate recovery will be faster. So for training sessions, I actually use a heart rate recovery more acutely during and post that session.
What are your thoughts on, is there a difference between endurance and strength trained athletes, i.e., certainly one of the training effects of chronic endurance training is this crazy bradycardia they have. I mean,
yep.
I know a couple of endurance athletes whose resting heart rate is below 40 and even approaching 30. So I guess how much variability is there when you're only beating 30 beats a minute? And then also, is there a difference based on the people who just do power training versus endurance training?
Yeah, as a whole, the people who do endurance training will have a much higher HRV, meaning they will be more on the parasympathetic side. And again, resting heart rate is a reflection of that. If my chronic resting heart rate goes down, that means that my HRV in general is going to be higher. So if you want to get really far down in the weeds and you look at a lot of athletes, one of the things I'll look at is how correlated is their heart rate variability to their resting heart rate? Most people, that should be pretty correlated, meaning that as they see chronic adaptations, one of them is a lowering of heart rate, their heart rate variability should go up. In a handful of people, I've seen that correlation breaks down a little bit, and that's telling me there's some other weird stressor they've got going on, like some eye issues, some vestibular issues. They've been knocked out a few times. There's something else going on with that. Wow. So usually endurance athletes will fare much better with that. Again, that goes back to knowing that for a measurement status, then if I just have like I had an endurance athlete, their resting heart rate's 37. When they took their HRV measurement lying down first thing in the morning, it literally almost never changed. Like they had to go out and do like an all-night bender of like 5 drinks and sleep 4 hours and their HRV would change. So a lot of the emails I get from people are like, heart rate variability is dog shit. I have this endurance athlete and it never changed. And I'm like, when did you measure it? Did you measure it when they're lying down? Did you measure it over sleep? They're like, yeah. You probably have to do a command and measurement standing to kind of get them a little bit more sympathetic. But because it's always measured standing and you're doing a variability analysis, that kind of drops out over time because they're more interested in the changes from day to day. So that's like a big kind of thing that people miss when they do the measurements.
Does HRV predict any clinical outcomes?
In some issues, so when I worked in the medical device industry, we implanted pacemakers and defibrillators. And later on, they actually measured heart rate variability all the time. So when they would do something where they would try to resynchronize the right side of the ventricle to the left side, so the right side of the heart to the left side, for heart failure, these are primarily what's called left bundle branch blocks, we would see heart rate variability would get much better over time. So in different pathologies like that, it can be used diagnostically to see how the therapy they're delivering is going. There's some other data in general showing that if you have better heart rate variability, you have a less chance of sudden cardiac death. There's some other data on that. The hard part, again, is it's not this nice, neat, linear curve. Because people email me all the time. They're like, hey, man, here's my HRV. Is this good? It's like, well, you know, you're kind of within the range of good, you know, because they think if I just look at milliseconds, like, oh, man, if I'm 80, you know, and I do all this endurance training, and I get to 110, like, I'm going to be so much better. It's like, eh. Not necessarily. You're on the high end of the curve and it kind of flattens out for benefits. Now, if you're 10 and you go to 30, yeah, you're probably going to see some pretty big, you know, pickups from that change.
Tony, do you think there's any value to it? Like, because mixed martial arts fighters, the volume of training is so ungodly high. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to use it as a predictor of whether or not, I guess, I don't know if the term is overreached or overtrained or...
You know, probably, and I think it would have to be with Mike's, you know, taking a look at what Mike's recommendations are regarding the timing. I mean, it's what we're looking for with those guys, obviously, is trends, not just HRV, right? Maybe three or four things going in. Whatever's going up that should be down is not good. Whatever's going down that should be up is not good. So I think it may be one of a collective group that has some great value. I would assume in most cases, as Mike said, there's some consistency with a decline in resting heart rate or an increase in recovery capacity and the HRV itself. So I think it has great value, to be honest, but I think two things are and that's why we're here today. What might be a good measurement tool? And if we're going to measure it in the MMA athlete, particularly during camp, Mike, where you know, you have your two or three training sessions per day. So that makes it even hard maybe to potentially get effective measurements post-training. But then again, limit it to sleep because this is what I'm learning right now from Mike, Dr. Mike here, is that there's too much room for variation if I'm doing it all day long in a stressful day where they're going from session to session and maybe gym to gym. So I think it can have a lot of utility. But as we're seeing here, I think we have to be very strategic is the word I'm getting in when we measure and for even potentially for the duration, right? Mike, is that right?
Yeah, and Joel Jamison has used this a lot too with mixed martial art athletes for many years and used Omega Wave and other systems. And yeah, you're correct. Like for 90 to 95% of people listening to this podcast, do a commanded measurement first thing in the morning, do it after they use the bathroom, don't drink any water, don't do anything else, just sit down, get in a calm state. Most people, it's going to be seated, like the rare endurance athletes can be standing, do the measurement, and then, you know, just log it, right? And so like Tony was saying, if you're going into a camp, you then have to take the HRV measurement and put it into the context of what you expect, right? So if you're, you know, in the middle of your camp, you're probably going to see the athletes are a little bit more stressed, right? Because they're doing a whole bunch of shit. But as you get closer to the fight, then you'd want to see that stress level going down so that they're at a more, you know, recovered type state. And so that's where I find that it's most useful, especially for, you know, athletes that you tell them, it's like, okay, you're going to run through a brick wall today. They're like, cool, coach, here I go. Right. You can show them the data because some of those athletes can do an ungodly amount of work. And so you want to titrate the work so they're getting the right adaptations, but they'll drive themselves in the red, like no problem. And a lot of times, they won't tell you. They're like, oh, coach, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Right.
So having other measurements, velocity-based stuff, watching their skills, watching resting heart rate, watching HRV, you could like, hey, man, we see these metrics and looks like you're getting close to kind of the max. So let's pull back for a few days. You're not a bad human being. Your body is just telling us that you're stressed. And then they kind of do that and like, oh, yeah, okay, I feel a little bit better. So I like having at least a couple measures that are not dependent on what they say. And then I want to calibrate that to what do they say? What are they feeling? Because as we all know, that's different for every athlete. So it gives you their perception, and then it gives you an actual physiologic measurement of the response of their system to everything that's going on.
Just to quickly, an excellent point, really great point, because the markers might tell you otherwise. And like you said, they're going to keep sucking it up and deny any of that. You're right. Great point.
Yeah, as you both are well aware, in our industry, not just the people who are the experts in it, but the people who exercise, who follow the advice online, that it tends to be quite a faddish industry. It's something, quote, new comes up and it's like, oh my God, I got to do that. You know, whether it's, following, I remember when the ketogenic diet was such a big thing, and now you don't hear much about it. The carnivore diet, you're starting to hear more about it, but I'm sure it'll go through its life cycle. Cold water immersion, that seems to be the sort of fad of the day. Everyone's buying, literally, I can't believe people are buying buckets just to sit in cold water. And that's, you know what? That's why Tony and I moved to Florida. We didn't like the cold. And Mike, remember when I was in Minnesota that one time?
Oh, yeah. It was the last time you were over there.
I was like, holy crap, I'm freezing my ass off. I can't do this cold stuff. So what are your thoughts on, I mean, there's two things that, your opinion on, just this faddish nature of our industry. And then specifically, using cold to do whatever.
Yeah, I mean, fitness has always been faddish. I think it was Alan Cosgrove who said once, there's like the over and under reaction to everything, right? You can just watch the pendulum swing from, no one had ever heard of cold water immersion 4 or 5 years ago, other than some Wim Hof and some crazy instructors, to now everyone's got to do cold water. And there's also then the subfraction of people who are like, cold water, I hate it. It's the stupidest thing ever, right? So you've got like the pendulum going back both ways. Sauna was kind of that way. And it's hard, I think, for consumers, because rarely is everything, as you guys know, black or white. So if you look at cold water immersion, I started doing it like right before COVID. I got a freezer, converted it, filled it full of water. I thought, let's see what this is about, because the research seemed kind of interesting. And for recovery, which I would say is in season, athletes training relatively hard. Again, this could be speed, power, vertical jump. Unfortunately, it's a mixed bag on whether it does actually help or not. Like, some data says yes, some data says no. But then you're looking at, okay, what did they use for protocol? How long did they do it? There's so many factors that go into it. We just don't have enough data to even make good meta-analyses or just make heads or tails. But most athletes I've worked with, they do tend to like cold water immersion, and they do tend to like it in season. And I'm generally fine with that, because if they feel better and they can perform better the next day or for the next game, cool. Like, I may give up a little bit of adaptation with it. Don't care. Like, if they can perform again, cool. That's awesome. Out of season, it gets a little bit trickier. And then if you look at hypertrophy, which again, most of the bros care about and everyone else does too, for good reason, there is some data showing that hypertrophy may be blunted from cold water immersion. Now, again, the caveat is, if you actually read the studies, the main study, which was done from Van Loon's lab, looked at 50 degrees Fahrenheit for up to 20 minutes. So most of the studies are at least 10 minutes or longer to see changes for hypertrophy. And so I went through for the physiologic flexibility cert and pulled all the studies, read them all, because in my brain, I'm like, okay, so if I translate this, what does that actually cost in terms of muscle hypertrophy? So if we take like the hypothetical, like highest gain, let's say you can add 12 pounds lean body mass a year, right? You're definitely an outlier. That's definitely the extreme, but it makes simple math. It's about a pound per month. If I do cold water immersion at 50 degrees Fahrenheit and I follow the study exactly, and I do 20 minutes and I do it immediately post-training, does that cost me half a pound, like a quarter of an ounce, like 3/4 of a pound? Like, what is the number in an actual, English sort of translation? Good and unfortunately, question. The answer is, I can't tell you.
Well, actually, you point to a larger scientific problem, not just with cold water immersion, but really a lot of the studies that look at muscle protein synthesis, these are all acute training. They're not training studies. They're just acute studies.
A lot of them are, yes.
Yeah, and so being able to give pragmatic advice on that, like you give the example of 1 pound a month for 12 months. Well, I know you ain't going to find anyone doing a 12-month time course study. It's just not right. going to happen. What about an 8-week study on cold water immersion? I haven't seen that either. What about a 4-week? And then you get into, well, what's the value of 4 weeks if someone's been doing it for a year? So there's all these limitations with it. And I take my attitude towards is actually the same with supplements. And, you know, when people say, well, what supplements, you know, would you recommend? And my attitude is, or my philosophy is, if it helps or has a neutral effect, use it. You know, if it does nothing, the worst that'll happen is you spend some money. But if it might help, use it. Now, with cold water immersion, as you mentioned, there might be an inhibition of muscle protein synthesis, but that's under those specific circumstances. What would happen if you play with the temperature, play with the duration? And the answer is nobody knows. So nobody knows. Now, I know a lot of people who do it and they basically say, well, I just feel better afterwards. And I'm like, okay, well, if you feel better afterwards, I just do it. I mean, I know a lot of the D2 athletes at our university, they do it. It's almost like as a matter of, it's almost a habit. A lot of coaches mm-hmm. will say, okay, sit in the tub, recover, blah, blah, blah. And maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't. I think a better recovery is maybe just have protein post-workout. We know that'll help you recover versus, you know, sitting in a cold tub. So I think it's just hard to do. It's really hard to do these time course studies. And those are really the ones. Those are really the ones that have to be done, not these acute, you know, let's sit in a tub for a few hours and then measure MPS. It's like, yeah, that's like, you know, I'll take the baseball analogy. That's like looking at the first pitch, saying, wow, that guy can throw. And then, yes. So is that supposed to predict how he throws in the seventh inning? Of course mm-hmm. not. So what sucks is most people will look at the acute stuff and not really ask, no one's doing the chronic stuff. The chronic stuff is actually the hard stuff to do.
Yeah, and I think with cold water immersion, last count, I could be wrong on this, there's only 4 chronic studies looking at hypertrophy, and I want to say the longest was 8 weeks. And, you know, some of them did muscle fiber, so they could show a difference in muscle fiber diameter. But as you know, Joey, because you did that work directly, how do you scale that up to a whole human? Like, you could statistically show there's a difference, but you can't translate that to what that means. The other one used DEXA, and it was within the limits of DEXA. Again, you pool all the subjects, you can see a difference. If you try to go down to an individual basis, it kind of breaks down. And they did show, right, directly, it does affect muscle protein synthetic response. The caveat I would add, though, is that most people would say it also affects inflammation. But the studies that I've looked at for that in healthy people, not pathologies, inflammation markers don't seem to change. Like, mm-hmm. so IL-6 and kind of your classic inflammation markers, TNF-alpha, they don't seem to change much at all. So I'm not convinced in healthy people it's changing inflammation. Now, pathologies, that might be different. We just don't have much data there.
Mike, do you think, do you want those inflammatory markers to change post-exercise?
Well, that's the other question, right? So my guess is that you probably want a bimodal response. Like after exercise, you probably want them to go up, right? You probably want to have some type of inflammation to, you know, help the healing process. But then you want them to come back down to baseline, and then you probably want to hit them again. You don't really want them to be chronically elevated, but you don't want to. You can look at some of the studies with NSAIDs. You don't want to purposely, you know, blunt them all the time.
Right.
And then that gets even messier if you look at adult, you know, older populations, NSAIDs. You know, Trappi did that study where they were, frankly, anabolic. So older adults responded different than younger adults. So,
yeah. Tony, are you at that age where you got to take NSAIDs in the morning like me?
I mean, I usually have them in the morning instead of my cereal with a little bit of milk and just
a breakfast. Bowl.
No, I don't use them that much. But the answer to that is I probably should regarding just mitigating pain. But I don't use them. I do. I've been really up in my mobility work and the joints are feeling pretty good. And yeah, by the way, just to me, one of the best things you can do, completely anecdotal, you want your body to feel pretty good again, get it in the water, get gravity off you, do some mobility work in the water, swim a little bit. And that in and of itself, I think, is a great method of recovery. But as far as the ibuprofen, I only use that for really bad days, Joey, really bad days. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I get into these weird habits. Like, I'll wake up and I'm like, man, I'm really stiff, kind of sore. My back hurts. So I take Advil. I take like three or four pills. And then I catch myself repeating that behavior every morning. I'm like, crap, I've been doing this straight for like 2 weeks. Maybe I should back off.
Yeah.
And just deal with the stiffness, the soreness, you know. And let's face it, Mike, we all know age always wins. So it's just what it is. Now, hey, let's change subjects. I want to talk to you about fasting, because that's another one of those faddish things. Intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding. I was listening to, I forget who, there's a guy who's like ubiquitous on social media. I think his name is, he's the guy who worked with Dana White, Brekka.
Gary Brekka.
Yeah, it's like, he's like, when, and I'm paraphrasing, because when I was listening to this, I'm like, how the hell does he know that? Well, from 0 to 10 hours, this is what happens with a 3-day water fast. And then from 10 to 20 hours, this happens. And then from 24, I'm like, wait, do we have data that is that precise? No. 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 24. Well, so fasting, it is faddish. We had God, Tony, who'd we have who talked about IF and chronic caloric restriction?
About what?
Texas Tech. Remember, I guess Texas Tech.
Oh, that was Grant.
Yeah, Grant Tinsley.
Grant Tinsley. Yeah, yeah.
Good guy.
Yeah, he's awesome.
From a purely body composition or body weight standpoint, there doesn't seem to be a difference fasting versus chronic caloric restriction. But tell us what your thoughts on it in terms of, is just, it's an additional way to basically restrict calories. Is there any special health benefits to it, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so I originally heard about fasting through Brad Pilon's book, Eat, Stop Eat, going back, oh God, probably a decade, 11 years ago. And back at that point, I was like, fasting? What is this? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, all the muscle is going to fall right off your body. This is the stupidest thing ever. And I never thought it would become popular. And so I read his book and I started looking at all the studies and I was like, oh, well, maybe it's not as bad for us as we thought. And so I always viewed it as, okay, maybe it's more neutral. And then, you know, fast forward many years, there's all these, you know, crazy, you know, autophagy and this and that and this and that and everything else.
Oh, autophagy, that's another one, but we'll get to that later.
But I did end up using it as intervention in the Flux Diet CERT, because when I started working with clients, I realized that, oh, if I took a very progressive manner, so I made a mistake of like, okay, I'm eating every couple hours, I'm going to try fasting for 24 hours. And it was a train wreck, right? And I tried again, still a train wreck. But then I realized, I'm like, oh, I'm an idiot. It'd be like someone coming to my gym at the time and being like, oh, bro, you've never deadlifted? Cool, let's put 405 on the bar and I'll just yell at you to try harder, right?
Wait, Mike, explain how you felt during that initial 24 hours, why you're like, holy shit, this is a dumb idea that I'm doing.
I felt like crap and I was hungry. And what I realized also was that for me at the time, eating every, you know, couple hours I was awake, to go for 24 hours, just like, you know, deadlifting 405, you know, if you've never started, it's just too big of a gap. So I said, okay, what if I just go and I skip breakfast starting on Monday? I skip breakfast just Monday and I just do normal the rest of the week. The following Monday, let's say I skip breakfast and then I don't eat till 1 p.m. So I took like 6 day weeks, just taking one day per week and just slowly built out the time that I was fasting. And when I did that, I realized, right, shocker, adaptation, I felt pretty good and it wasn't really that hard. And so when I started trying it with clients, I'd also tried very low caloric days, just eat one meal, all this other stuff. But when I did a very progressive manner, most people actually liked fasting. They came back and they said, wow, I actually like this. And when I was working with them, I realized, okay, if I get to 24 hours or 19 to 24 hours, that's an easy way of literally just chopping out a day's worth of calories from their total caloric load. And they could eat more normal, quote unquote, the rest of the time. So from a compliance standpoint, if it was progressive, I found it was actually super useful. And then when I was looking and researching metabolic flexibility, I was also trying to think, I'm like, okay, what else can we do to potentially make someone more sensitive to insulin and get them to try to use more fat as a fuel? And obviously exercise helps, sleep helps, but, you know, shocker, if you just don't eat, right, your insulin levels go down. That does push your body to use more fat acutely as a fuel source. And then obviously you're cutting out a whole amount of calories for that period of time. And there is some interesting studies looking at fasting as a way to increase and to resensitize the body's ability to use fat as a fuel again. If you're relatively metabolically healthy, metabolically flexible, it's pretty easy. Those people don't need a lot of work. There's a study done in people who are borderline obese, type 2 diabetics. It took up to 48 hours of fasting for their insulin levels to kind of come all the way back down again. So I like using it because it's been relatively easy with clients. It's a good way to cut out a whole bunch of calories. On the health side, I think there may be some implications helping the body to use fat better as a fuel. Now, again, we don't know if that magically translates to you losing a bunch of fat or anything like that. It's just another intervention to do. The downside is, like, the benefits of it generally have been, like, way oversold. Stuff from, like, an earthworm doesn't necessarily scale up to humans, right? The closer you get to mammals, like, the more a lot of those studies just don't translate much at all. So I think there might be some health benefits if you're already unhealthy. That's debatable. We don't have a whole lot of data there. That's just my guess at this point. But it's also extremely hard to set up a study where you don't have that, you know, caloric deficit also, right? So most of the studies that have looked at that would say currently most of the benefit does come from having that type of caloric deficit when they've compared them to each other. So
Tony, when fighters are cutting weight, do they employ basically, I'll just eat less throughout the day, or do some of them use time-restricted feeding or some sort of fasting technique?
Yeah, I think that there was a time where I think they were time-restricting unintentionally, just not eating enough. And that was the, you know, they did that largely because they were coming into camp probably with weights at about 18 to 22% above scale. They were less cognizant of maintaining good body composition in the off season, Joey. So I think it was unintentional. They had little option but to, you know, wake up in the morning, train, and not eat. And that was a behavior with really no intent from a fasting standpoint or the being cognizant of the benefits of fasting. Just that's what they needed to do. And that's how they felt about it, to restrict calorically. I think we see less of it now, and I'm thankful for that, particularly as you get into camps. I think what people tend to forget is, can you suck it up, you know, physically? I mean, yeah, you can get through practice. You got some glycogen left over. As Mike said, if you're in good condition, you can pull some fats at various points throughout the course of the training day. But I can't see any benefit when you're trying to process cognitively at very high speeds. And that's where the brain, I think, is, you know, really going to need its glucose. Can you spill enough from the liver at that point, maybe, to get through one practice? But how are you going to get through two? You know, so I'm not a proponent of it in sport, not during camps or not where there are high cognitive demands and where the motor skill applications are very complicated. Like, I don't, you know, if you're going to go for a long run, I'm not condemning running. I think endurance athletes are incredible. You have to overcome the pain. There's much you have to overcome. But it's not like doing an aerial on a balance beam. And I don't want to do that fasted. The brain has to probably, right? And I'll let Mike elaborate on this, but the brain needs quite a bit of fuel at a ferocious pace when you have to, particularly with reaction time, response, and so forth, right?
So yeah, and I would agree with that. I mean, you can look at, like, liver glycogen overnight after a fast will be relatively depleted.
Right.
You can fast for like 2 days and muscle glycogen won't really be tapped at all. Again, exactly. The assumption is you're not doing a lot of muscular work.
Right.
Once that starts escalating and you're fasting and you're doing a high output of more glycolytic type work, yeah, I mean, pretty much any athlete on the face of the planet is going to be like, yeah, I don't feel so good at the after the sessions.
Now, Mike, you had mentioned, and I forgot to ask you about this, you had mentioned the, fasting versus chronic caloric restriction, and a lot of the benefits are just from, you're just restricting calories, losing weight, et cetera, et cetera. What about the claims of cold water immersion promoting the loss of body fat?
Oh boy. So when I looked at the research on this, my thought pattern was, okay, maybe there's something to this, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my background was in mechanical engineering, so I suffered through thermal. I did a My thesis was actually on heat transfer. So stick a monkey in front of a big microwave transmitter and blast the monkey and look at, you know, heat transfer effects in the head and stuff. And so you know that cold water does leach, you know, heat from the body really fast. We know humans are homeotherms. They have to keep about, you know, 98.6 temperatures, actually about 97.7. And so when I looked at it, I was kind of secretly hoping. I'm like, man, I hope this works. Because doing cold water immersion sucks when you do it. This is not fun. And unfortunately, I was very disappointed. Again, that I think you can get there. There is an old... So the military spent a lot of money looking at this, right? Because if soldiers are in, you know, they go overboard, or they, how long can they hang out in the water? So this is... You look at some very old research, like there's a fair amount of research in that area. And what you find is... For body comp, I think the one study was they put them in basically a freezer at like 41 degrees. This was air in like a pair of shorts for like an hour and a half or some crazy amount of time. And this is a chronic study. And they did see a fair amount of weight loss with that. They didn't look at body comp. The cold water itself, not much. In theory, if my back of the envelope calculations are even remotely close to right, you have to be in for quite a long time. And you have to be into the point where you're frankly just shivering and cold for a long time after. Again, safety factors, obviously there's a big risk with that. I'm not recommending anybody do this. I may have tried that a few times in my garage and take a bunch of measurements, and it is absolutely horrible. Like to sit in there with your teeth chattering and to be cold for like 3 to 4 hours after for some theoretical benefit that I can't point to from any study. Yeah, no.
Yeah. You guys remember a book called Life Extension by Dirk Pearson and Sandy
Shaw? Sandy Shaw?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was one of the, I read this book a long time ago, and one of the things they recommended for losing fat, and I remember reading this, I'm like, they're insane. They said, make your house really cold.
Yep.
Make your house really cold, and you'll shiver all day, and shivering is just another way to expend energy, obviously. And you'll lose body fat, or you'll lose weight, or whatever. And I'm thinking, who the hell is going to do that? I mean, in Minnesota, you know, you can just open the windows in the winter.
Yeah.
You'll shiver, like, all day.
In Florida, that would cost you $2,500 a month to keep your AC at a level where you'll shiver all day.
Right. Yeah, imagine the AC running just so you could shiver. I'm like, holy crap. Yeah, you're right, $2,500 a month. Hey, Mike, last topic. I want to talk to you about rep ranges, because... Mm-hmm. In the last half decade or so, the idea that, you know, in terms of muscle hypertrophy, at least not strength, you know, whether it's high volume, low load, or high load, low volume, or low reps, it sort of doesn't matter how you achieve hypertrophy. You sort of, you'll get to the same place, just we're taking a different road.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Brad Schoenfeld has done some of those studies. You can go back to one of the first studies was done by Nick Bird from Stu Phillips' lab. Right, so the range is probably as low as 30% of 1RM up to 85% of 1RM. You might even be able to go higher than that. It was just that study, the amount of time they spent lifting to equate volume was a lot. And if you talk to people in it, I think they might have even reported this in the study, or I got it from Brad directly, is that they had a lot more joint pain. They just didn't feel as good.
Wait, high rep group or low grip?
The high load group. Right,
so
like the 85% of the 1RM. Yeah. And that makes sense, right? You're using a heavier load, so you're probably going to have more, you know, stress on the joints. So that kind of adds up, especially when you're equating volume across both groups. Again, if you want more strength, you probably have to be, you know, a little bit on the heavier load. That's even a little bit more in question from talking to Stu Phillips. They looked at a couple studies where, you know, because most of these studies, if it's a chronic study, they have whatever implement they're doing. But the measurements are usually done on an isokinetic machine in order to get all these cool numbers and stuff off it, which I totally get. But that's a different thing that you're measuring than what you were doing in the study in most cases, but not every case. So Stu was saying that they had a couple studies that they equated them. So they had them practice isokinetic for like 2 sessions and then looked at their strength instead of just putting them on the Biodex and, you know, running it. And they didn't see nearly as much of a strength gain as what the other studies showed. So maybe it's like this hyper-specific learning effect. Maybe just by getting the muscle bigger, you do get more strength gains than what we realize. you know, again, these are probably not elite level athletes we're looking at during the studies either, and they're limited over time course. But it is interesting because I used to be very much of the, if you want to get strong, you have to definitely lift heavier. And I do think that's generally true to specificity. However, there's probably more positive transfer from a lot of stuff, I think, than what we realize also, which, man, trying to sift through all that stuff makes it very hard and takes a lot of studies to put together.
And just a thought too, Mike, because we're seeing some research now that is telling us that we don't have to go the compound route or multiple joint route in order to stimulate more. We can isolate each group and potentially get the aggregate would be the same in each targeted area. What are your thoughts on that from what we're seeing?
Probably. I mean, I agree with most of those studies, right? Okay. Again, if you're looking at getting relatively close to failure, most of those studies would show that, yeah, you can get probably equivalent hypertrophy. So I do admit for more general population that I train, I do use more machines now for hypertrophy than I did in the past. The caveat I will give, though, is that those tend to be more intermediate to advanced lifters also. Okay. And it's an online environment. And I don't trust a lot of them getting close to failure on, like, you know, squat, bench, deadlift, you know, things that are more technical without somebody watching them. So I think you can make, like, one of the templates I use a lot is Monday, Wednesday, Friday, maybe squat, bench, deadlift as your main exercise. And my goal is more performance with that. And I add more load over time. I want it to be very technically precise. And then I'll do more accessory work with machines. And I mean, crap, if you're going to, you know, almost failure or failure on a leg extension, I'm not that worried, right? And so if you want some level of performance and you want some hypertrophy, but you want to err and be a little bit more safe,
makes sense.
I've used more of that template a lot now than I did 5 years ago.
Right, great.
Last question, and we'll wrap it up, Mike. Sort of a fun question. What supplements would you recommend for someone who basically trains for general fitness? They do some cardio, they do some weights. They're like, hey, Dr. Mike, could you tell me what supplements might help? I eat pretty well most of the time. So what would you recommend?
I would start with a protein supplement, more just out of convenience, right? If you're hitting all your protein with real food, great. I don't need it. Creatine, 5 grams per day, monohydrate, don't need anything fancy. Fish oil, 2 to 4 grams per day, depending on how deficient they are. I have a little blood spot test I use to see where the levels are at. And the other one that the data is, I'd say, conflicting. I actually use a high-dose multivitamin, multi-mineral supplement. There's some data showing that under high-stress conditions, it appears to be beneficial. They did some cool studies where they put researchers out after, like, some of the earthquakes in New Zealand, some of the floods in North Dakota, and they gave one group placebo and they gave another group the high-dose multivitamin, because the thought process was, this is a high external stressor environment, and let's just look to see what happens. Both those studies, granted they're done by the same research group, did show that the multivitamin group was better. Again, general population, not necessarily athletes, maybe their diet sucks, but I haven't seen much of a downside with that. Their stress tolerance appears to go up a little bit. After that, depends on what they're trying to do. You know, caffeine once in a while for performance, and then it just gets into hyper-specific single-digit percentages of what you want to get after that.
Right.
That's right. Well, if it helps or has a neutral effect, I say give it a shot. So, Mike, where can people find out more about you? Are you giving any seminars between now and ISSN? Where can people find you?
Oh, yeah, and I didn't want to interrupt, Mike, but just
go ahead.
Give us a quick minute on what they learned, because I know you've worked hard on your certification too, and maybe a quick minute on what that cert entails.
Sure. So the first cert is the Flex Diet certification. So it's based on nutrition and recovery. So everything from sleep to the macronutrients, NEAT, et cetera. Okay. And then how do you take that and learn the theory? And then the big principle is metabolic flexibility, flexible dieting. And then we have very specific action items that they need to do.
Okay,
the second one is the level 2, the physiologic flexibility cert, looking at homeostatic regulators. So temperature, right? Hot, cold exposure, pH, breathing, and then also expanded fuels. So everything from ketones to lactate. And then all the stuff you can find for me is at miketnelson.com. I do have some stuff on Instagram once in a while, which is just Dr. It's Dr. Miketnelson. And then most information I put out is on the newsletter. So if you go to MikeTNelson.com, just scroll down, you can get on the newsletter, and most information goes out that way.
Great. So I repeat, that is MikeTNelson.com. That is MikeTNelson.com. Dr. Mike, I want to thank you for being on the Sports Science Dude. You are an official Sports Science Dude. So.
Oh, nice.
Cool. We'll send the certification in the mail. So.
Oh, perfect. Yay.
Hey, well, thanks. And hey, you enjoy the holidays. Have a Merry Christmas. Have a great New Year. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate
it. We'll see you soon. Thanks again.
Yeah, see you guys soon. Take care.